here's an interesting headline for you in the Washington Post today. I wonder what Bob Ney might know about this. The time Obama walked in on a staffer who had a friend in bed. What the heck is that all about? All right, actually, he probably wants to talk more about how Mitt Romney's going to take a third run here at being president. Good morning, Robert.
Let's talk about the staffer. That's more interesting than Mitt Romney.
What's that all about?
What is it? I haven't seen that article yet.
Oh, all right. I thought you
were in the White House?
I'll do a quick read here while you talk here.
Wow.
Reggie Love knows how to put the body in body man, it says here. In a memoir due out in early February, Love recounts his years working for Barack Obama in the Senate on the 2008 campaign and in the White House, fresh out of Duke University, where he'd been captain of the Blue Devils basketball squad. Love joined Team Obama in 2007, soon became the senator's personal aide, a role we keep through the primaries, general election, most of the term. The two got to know one another, and so sometimes they said they got to know each other too well. In a 2007 campaign stop in West Palm Beach, during a particularly stressful time on the trail, an old friend from college visited Love. She ended up staying the night, Love writes in his memoir. The next morning, Love was up getting ready for the day, and his guest was still in bed. It was then that Obama suddenly let himself into the hotel room, Love explains, using a Secret Service master key, and found this young woman in bed. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah. great headline, not much there. So what's the story? Mitt Romney really is pretty serious here about running for a third time. Huh.
Well, Mitt Romney's out there, Jeb Bush, and it's not just like a feeler thing. He's serious, and I really was in shock when I heard he was, and now that they've actually uttered it, I'm in more shock. Something's got to give, and now it's a Republican, Jeb Bush, who's releasing all his tax information that's going to be after Romney. First it was Obama, now it's going to be Bush.
Yeah. Yeah, boy, I am surprised. I thought he really was pretty much done after that last campaign.
Well, I think he is. He thinks he isn't.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Huh.
Not that what I count, makes Mitt make his decision, but
right.
I think a lot of other people feel the same way.
Right. I know you're in Ohio, not in Washington, but this story that's continuing this morning with the Metro. I got to tell you, I think I was at this Metro station about a week ago. Electrical problem. You got one person dead and a number of people really pretty severely injured with smoke inhalation.
You were at the same Metro stop?
Yeah. Right in that area there. Yeah.
I mean, the D.C. Metro has had a wonderful history, actually, of less crime and the way it has run in the past. I mean, it's had a really, really good history, but they had that smoke filled Metro station, and then there's one person dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we've been having a fairly robust discussion, or we did yesterday on the program, talking about the situation in France. And boy, I mean, it was about nine different angles that people came at on this. But one of the questions that came up was why we focus so much attention on a dozen people that were killed in France, when we have 1,000 people that were killed in, I think it was Nigeria, and we've got, as some people point out, we've got a number of Palestinians every day killed too. So why do we put the focus where we put the focus?
Well, it's because ISIS is. I mean, let's go to a domestic issue. The heroin epidemic in America, and I mean epidemic.
Yeah.
So many people are dying of heroin. I mean, it's going to surpass wars we've been in.
Yeah.
But, we tend to focus on an element that brings emotion and terror. We don't we don't have Palestinians running into places and over, in Europe and, blowing things up. They do it in Israel, and Israel deals with it. And Israel doesn't deal with it by shutting down all the restaurants in the neighborhood where one was blown up. I mean, I'm not going to say they're used to it. They deal with it, though.
Mm-hmm.
But this whole ISIS issue, I mean, they're savvy on electronic media. They've recruited people. Now you've got Senator Feinstein saying, well, we can't have a visa waiver program, So now we're going to just stop everybody from coming here. We're going to torture people to come travel to America. We're going to destroy the entire tourism industry. And it's all, you know, to hope that nobody else gets in when, meanwhile, somebody could walk across the border somewhere, possibly down in Mexico, not to pick on Mexico, but be a terrorist and get in here. But we just react with, you know, we're so focused on one thing. And then the other sad thing is there's not really much we do about it.
Mm-hmm.
ISIS and Al-Qaeda are there. They have central points. And you have to either go in and completely eradicate them, or we're going to continue to deal with this for the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's the emotion, honestly, of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the emotion gets the attention, I think, Mark.
Yeah. You know, one of the other things that I wanted to ask you about is I saw somebody sent me a link to a video of a broadcast that spoke about how there are these zones all throughout Paris and in other parts of France.
That are no-go zones.
Yeah, that the government calls no-go zones, where they really, I don't know how it's articulated. Do you know? I mean, how is it articulated that these are not areas that are safe for people to go? You know, ambulances try to avoid it too. It's really quite scary that there are places where the government has basically written off and said that they're not safe for white people to go.
Well, it's, you know, they have these zones. Now, by the way, there are, and I don't want to build this, you know, to what it's not, but there are zones in America where we will not go into because they're Sharia-controlled communities. There's one in New York, and it's debatable of what they're really about, and there's a lot of debate, but they have their own structure, their own authority, and they live under a form of Sharia law, and we have them in America. These no-go zones are areas where it's just, you know, there's these areas they've created where I don't think it's really a formal, official, you know, proclamation. But people have designated where there are the no-go zones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then there's the no-go zones that are, they're off limits to non-Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's about, in France, I think, Mark, there's about 700 of these.
Yeah, 750 is what I saw.
Okay, 750 of these Muslim communities. And again, in America, if my memory serves me correct, we have maybe 16 of these now. They don't tell you that legally you can't come in, but, you know, there's a gate and they'll let in who they want.
Yeah. But what does that say about this whole idea of, you know, can we all actually get along, this idea of multiculturalism, which the leader of Germany has now declared to be a failure?
Yeah, well, there's two arguments to what's happened, for example, in France. These no-go zones, you know, the French Muslims got, you know, coalesced together. And that's because they were discriminated against in France. So some of the people in France, non-Muslims, have said, yes, you know, we drove them into doing this by segregating them. Other people say, no, they want to live under a Sharia law versus a, you know, form of a democratic law.
Mm-hmm.
And so there might be a little bit of truth to both, but the fact remains we have them. And how can a community sit there and just say, we're not going to follow the law of your country, we're going to do what we want?
Yeah.
But then you have to start raiding them. I mean, there's all kinds of problems with that.
Did, you know, I wonder about this practice. I know France instituted a number of things, you know, included banning the scarf and that sort of thing. I wonder about the effectiveness of that.
Yeah, well, the banning of the scarf, I mean, I think that, you know, there's certain things, obviously, that are cultural, and it'd be like us saying you couldn't wear a yarmulke somewhere, you know, which would not go well.
Yeah.
But again, there's also, you know, radical elements that are preaching to, you know, go after non-Muslims, and that's out there, and only the Muslim community can really, you know, the leaders of the Muslim community can come out and try to stop this. The only other way to stop the radical element, like ISIS, is to kill them. So I mean, it's a long, ongoing problem. But we do have to have, I think, the dialogue domestically of what's causing this, you know, feeling of discrimination or separation.
Yeah. Anything else you want to mention?
Just that the continuing saga of why didn't the president go will probably last a couple more days. depends on the if the White House, you know, is a statement of we made a mistake, we'll let it all die. They kind of just dug a deep hole that made people look a little bit more intensely.
So why didn't John Kerry go to this thing?
Well, I don't know why they didn't send somebody. Look, Eric Holder was in a meeting across the street, basically.
Oh, you're
and
kidding.
And he said he had to go somewhere.
Wow.
Well, Attorney General of the United States doesn't meet with the President of France and then decide, you know, well, I just don't think I'll go to that rally. Somebody had to have said, well, no, you're not going to go. Now, I don't think it was probably because of, you know, some feeling of support of radical Muslims, but man, what an error of not sending somebody. I mean, and then they said, well, the president would be a security risk. Netanyahu was at the front of the line.
Mm-hmm.
You want to talk about security risk?
Mm-hmm.
Right there. So somebody really made a bad, bad call on this one.
Mm-hmm. Who makes that call anyway?
Well, usually it'll go to there's this chief of staff, and then there's, you know, kind of the president's main person that runs the system. But usually something of this level goes all the way up the food chain, and the chief of staff usually weighs in and says, okay, because, you know, he has people report to him when things happen.
Mm-hmm.
Members of Congress, when people die in their districts in a war, they immediately are called by the military. Immediately, we were called. And you make a decision, and your chief of staff kind of weighs all that. So I would take the blame on this one to the chief of staff.
Mm-hmm. I got to let you gloat just a little bit. Go Buckeyes.
Oh, yeah. Can you believe it? Woof. Wilderness in Oregon, the duck pond. I mean, I can go on and on.
Well, that was a blowout, huh?
Oh, amazing.
No, you didn't even have any bad calls that you won by or anything like the pro games all weekend.
I didn't think it was going to be that close.
Yeesh. Boy. Did you watch any of those pro games? I mean, that call was so bad over the weekend. The catch that they claim was not. Wow.
Well, I'll tell you what, Ohio State just, and it's a young team, so should be around for a while.
Uh-huh. Well, not that long, Bob. You know, it is university.
Yeah, well, no. Look, sports is the heart of it all.
It's the only thing that really, truly matters, right, Bob?
Yes, it is, in that university.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Bob Ney, former congressman from Ohio. He joins us from the services of Talk Radio News Service. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about vineyards. We're going to head down to Barnard. We're going to talk this morning with Deirdre Heekin. She's the author of An Unlikely Vineyard, back after this.
Looking for a cost-effective way to get your message and image before the public?
This is Brian at Always On Time Signs and Designs. We make attractive, well-designed signage in a variety of forms.
This is Rory with in-house sign design for everything from traditional business signs to vehicle lettering and even full vehicle wraps. Your image will be seen and remembered by thousands.
The variety we offer with fast turnaround is limited only by your imagination. Banners, in-store floor and window graphics, and even special event items like trade show tablecloths.
Bring your ideas to us. Whatever your budget is, we can help you accomplish your marketing goals at Always On Time Signs and Designs.
Your order will be done on time, on budget, every time. Call us at 223-8948 or toll free from anywhere at 1-800-547-0808.
Always On Time Signs and Designs, 115 Industrial Way in Berlin.
Again, we can be reached at 223-8948 or 1-800-547-0808.
With so many Medicare drug discount card options, making the right choice is a little overwhelming. That's why you should stop by your local Medicine Shop Pharmacy, 20 South Main Street in Barrie. Our knowledgeable pharmacists will walk you through the plans. They'll find the one that meets your needs and, most importantly, saves you money. When you have a trusted Medicine Shop pharmacist at your disposal, you can make confident decisions about your health care. Treat your health and your budget. Learn more about Medicare drug discount cards from Medicine Shop pharmacists today at 20 South Main Street in Barrie.
I'm Dr. Nils Giddens, a pediatric cardiologist at the University of Vermont Children's Hospital. When it comes to childhood obesity, I believe an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I regularly see chronic illnesses in children, like high blood pressure and diabetes, that once only affected adults but now impact children for life. Increasing the price of sugary drinks can make an important impact. Our children will drink less of them, and Vermont can use the funding for programs in communities to help us all eat healthier and be more active. Together, we can help. Learn more at healthiervt.org.
Maplefields and Irving want you to ski for free. Fill up three times with Irving gasoline at their newest Maplefield store in downtown Newport, just off I-91 in St. Johnsbury, or any other Maplefield Irving locations, and you'll be eligible to receive a buy one, get one free lift pass at great local mountains like Burke, Jay Peak, Smugs, and Bolton Valley. With these new Maplefield locations, a great cup of coffee is never far away when you're on your way for an exciting day at the slopes. Come see them during their grand opening celebration in St. Johnsbury on January 22nd, 23rd, or 24th for awesome specials and prizes.
Moment of your time for our friends at Jet Service Envelope. If you need to get anything printed, how about ink and paper matching and going together here? Just about any combination of that, you can make it happen at Jet Service Envelope, a great local printer. And if you want to get information about how you can get your memoirs published, you know, have an interesting life, that helps. And you can also get some beautiful brochures done for your business, some nice trifold brochures. And you can all do all of that by calling them at 229-9335. That's 229-9335. And you can also find them on the World Wide Web. And that would be at jetservice-envelope.com. Oh, my goodness. What a beautiful book Deirdre Heekin has put together, An Unlikely Vineyard. The Education of a Farmer and Request for Terroir. We're going to be kind enough to have her join us on the line this morning. And you can join us as well at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. Toll free 877-291-8255. Deirdre and her husband Caleb live down in Barnard, Vermont. They also operate a restaurant that is sourced from many of the items that they grow on their own farm, where they, in addition to having some vineyards, they also grow heirloom apples, pears, and plums, and have all sorts of vegetable gardens, too. Deirdre, thank you very much for joining us. How are you this morning?
I'm great, Mark. How are you doing this morning?
You know, I'm good. You know, I just have this funny, weird feeling, though, when I'm reading this book, that it's really more about life than growing vegetables or grapes.
Well, I, you know, for me, that all goes together. You know, the growing the vegetables and having the vineyard and the orchard is about our life. So I think you're on the mark there.
But, you know, I'm always getting, I understand that. I mean, everything weaves together. But it's almost like there are these lessons in how to tend a vineyard that you almost feel like can be extended and extrapolated to, you know, other parts of your life. Am I reading too much into your book?
No, I think that's, I mean, I love that you're reading that in the book. I think that's great. And, I mean, certainly for me, this whole journey has been, you know, as you're saying, kind of all-inclusive. It's not just about the day-to-day life at the farm and in the vineyard and at the restaurant, but it's, you know, I do take those lessons into other areas of my life. And that's the, I think that's the beauty of doing this kind of work. It's not isolated in just growing a vegetable. It's, has a broader, I guess a broader meaning, that one can take through life.
Mm-hmm. But give me an example of what you think I might be talking about here. You know, for example, what have you learned from the garden that you would extend into your life?
Oh, well, you know, perseverance is one thing I would say. And, you know, the old adage, you know, try and try again. Because, you know, when you're working with a piece of land, you are getting to know it like you're getting to know a person. So as you go through that process, you're going to make many, many mistakes, like we do, I guess, in relationships. You know, it's give and take, and I don't mean to say that we make tons of mistakes in relationships, but there is that sense of feeling someone out, feeling a new friend out, and a person that we meet, and a piece of land is a lot like that, and the idea that we just continue on, even though we may come across a difficult patch, just as we might with a friend or a partner. You go through a rough patch, you go through a misunderstanding, a miscommunication, we persevere and we work through it. And I would say I would do the same I have the same response to working in the garden or the vineyard. This thing is happening in our environment with the weather pattern in this season, with the soil this season, and I have to persevere and work through that and learn something from that. And then those things that I learn, I take into the next season, even though the next season won't be the same. I don't know if that makes sense. But
totally. It's exactly what I was talking about. Thank you for articulating it better than I did. And sometimes those friendships and relationships don't start out so well, as just like yours with the land. You didn't really know anything about what you were doing, did you?
No. I think that that's maybe one of our advantages, that we tend to dive right into things. And we learn as we go along. And when I say we, I mean my husband, Caleb, and myself. We tend to get really inspired by something and intrigued by something and just go for it. And that has been very much how we've approached working on this piece of land and with our two vineyards that we lease over in the Champlain Valley. It's just diving right in and working actually somewhat improvisationally. We're actually both trained in improvisational dance. It was something we studied when we first met each other back in college, and I think that that has served us really, really well in how being able to respond, you know, in that immediate way, and to, again, going back to taking these things that we learn from one situation to the next. I'm going to say improvisational is, being improvisational is a really good thing.
We're talking with Deirdre Heekin. She's the author of An Unlikely Vineyard. How did you and Caleb wind up in Barnard?
So we found Barnard, or maybe it found us, because we moved initially down to Woodstock. We had been living in the Middlebury area, and we were looking for a spot to open a bakery, actually. And this is about 18 or so years ago. And we had looked at several locations around the state. We looked at Burlington. We looked at the Dorset, Manchester area. And we were really also interested in the Upper Valley, sort of Hanover, Woodstock area. And it happened that a space became available in Woodstock. And we decided to go for it, jump right in, and lived in Woodstock for that first year of our bakery and cafe, and knew that we were looking for a house and a piece of land, though I don't think we really knew at that juncture exactly how we wanted to connect with that piece of land. But we started looking, and a woman who had started coming into the bakery, who became a very good friend, she came in one day and said, you know, the property across the street has gone on the market again and has just gone down in price, and I think you guys should go look. And it turned out that our landlord for the space we were renting for the bakery, his son happened to be the realtor for this property.
Okay.
So we were able to connect with him that afternoon and came up to see it, and kind of had this lightning strike moment that there was something about this piece of property in Barnard that really spoke to us. And we didn't really understand that complete message at first, but we knew that this was a place we wanted to be.
Hmm. What was it about it? Now that you think back on it, what was it that was so magical about it?
One of the things that really drew us was it's a what I would call a high alpine meadow, or so we're near the top of what is called Mount Hunger, in this little chain of mountains called the Delectable Mountains, and it's very open, and we have incredible 70-mile views, you know, out to New Hampshire and into northern Vermont. And we, both Caleb and I, are really drawn to open spaces. I grew up in southern Indiana, which is all about, you know, big sky and some flat but also rolling hills. And Caleb grew up in Brattleboro, which is in a valley, but there are also some mountain meadows, and he grew up at the top of one of those meadows and also had big views. So that was something that really spoke to us here.
Mm-hmm. You write, though, that whenever I speak or write of our farm, the farm always asserts itself. What does that mean?
Well, I think for a long time, you know, we didn't really, you know, we knew we were gardening, but we didn't really necessarily see ourselves as farmers early on. And it became this kind of, a process of I'm trying to think of how to describe it. It's like when all of a sudden we started talking about it instead of as our restaurant gardens or we're in the garden, it started to slowly become the farm. And that was a very startling revelation when we started to use that word because we didn't imagine that we could turn this into a quote-unquote farm. You know, a farm meant something really particular. It meant really working the land, really getting to know the land. And I think that we felt maybe we weren't qualified or ready for that, or sort of qualified for that at that juncture. But it just started to happen, and it seeped into our language, and then we sort of turned and looked at each other, and we're like, you know, this is what we're doing. We are farming.
Were you terrified? I mean, you know, when you write about how your first gardens were, quote, lessons in humility, I mean, I'm thinking to myself, there might have been moments here where you're saying, what on earth are we doing?
Yes, and there still are. You know, that's a constant, because it's a constant learning curve. And granted, I mean, we've learned a terrific amount in the last 17 years that we've been farming this parcel, but every day is, you know, a new and different day, and you do kind of think, like, wow, how did we get here, number one, and, you know, number two, what are we doing? And especially early on, you definitely have that feeling of being in way over your head, or at least we did, because we didn't come at it from having gone to school for this or worked for other farmers or for a CSA. We came at it from the plate, from the table, and cooking and studying wine. So our doorway was slightly different. And, you know, I think that that's been an interesting way to approach it. But, yeah, we definitely have had that, oh, my gosh, what have we gotten ourselves into?
What were you and your husband doing before?
So right before we had the restaurant,
yeah.
Bakery cafe,
yeah.
So Caleb was cooking and working in Middlebury. He had been doing that for about 4 years prior to us opening our own place. And I was working for a publisher and in graduate school for creative writing.
244-1777 is our local number, toll-free 877-291-8255. We're talking with Deirdre Heekin. She's the author of An Unlikely Vineyard. All right, so let's talk about the vineyard part about this. I mean, talk about going against gravity here. You don't really know much about farming. I'm betting you probably didn't know a whole lot about growing grapes.
So by the time I got around to wanting to grow grapes, I at least had education. In my work at the restaurant, I'm the sommelier and wine director, so I have had a lot of experience, as I said, on the table side of wine. I do a lot of wine education. I choose our wine list. I have really great relationships with the producers that I curate on our wine list, and we go and visit a lot of vineyards and wineries when we take time off from the restaurant. So I had some working knowledge of the process, some working knowledge of how a vineyard is set up, some working knowledge of farming practices before I dove into the vineyard. But the reason I started to want to make wine and then ultimately plant grapes to make wine was to actually educate myself for my work as a wine director. Because I knew intellectually all these processes that happen from the field into the cellar for wine, but I hadn't had an opportunity to go work harvest with a producer or, you know, work in a cellar for a period of time for someone else. I wanted to do it on my own, and it kind of goes back to that improvisational dance training. I wanted to go through the motions, you know, feel the process kinesthetically, you know, what it means to make wine, and to be able to bring that to my wine education that I was doing at the restaurant. So that was how I got into doing the wine. And granted, I mean, you know, yes, diving in and not really knowing what I was doing, but at least I had some grounding. I think more so than when we started to do the gardening and the vegetable farming.
Mm-hmm. How difficult has it been?
Oh, it has been wonderful and difficult at the same time, and difficult in only that you, because I'm learning as I go along, and also we have a relatively small wine region community here. I mean, it's growing every year, but we don't have a huge network. We have a small network of people here that we can talk to and learn from each other. So I would say that's sort of the hardest part. I don't have next door to me, you know, a fifth generation wine producer mm-hmm. that I can ask questions about what has it been like to farm, you know, your parcel right next to mine, you know, for the last 500 years. We just don't have that kind of information here. So that's kind of the toughest thing. But at the same time, it's also very exciting and very liberating. It means that we are in the new frontier of wine. We don't have set down rules that we have to follow, that wine cultures that have been around a lot longer do have rules that they have to follow. And we are very lucky in that we're making our own rules as a new wine region.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by that.
So, for example, say in Italy, there is a governmental organization called the DOC or the DOCG. In France, it's called the AOC. And they are organizations that are that were created to help preserve the terroir of a given place that's growing wine.
Mm-hmm.
So there are certain rules and regulations about what you can plant, how much of it you can plant, percentages of certain kinds of grapes that can go into your wine,
right,
if they are going to be listed under that DOC or DOCG or AOC organization. Now, certainly you can, there are ways to make wine in both Italy and France that are outside of the DOCG or AOC, but it is much more difficult. And so we are very liberated in that we don't have those kinds of rules. The only place designation we have right now is Vermont.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you're using grapes that are totally different than California, Italy, France?
Yes, though some grapes that are related to the grapes that we are using do get used in France and were used historically in France. And what we're using are cold hardy varietals, which are horticultural crosses or hybrids between what we would consider European varietals that they grow in California. They grow some in upstate New York and certainly on Long Island, and what would be considered native wild stock here in North America.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so excited about them because I think of them as really uniquely American. They are a true melting pot, just like we all are. We have all this, you know, European stock, and then we've got this native stock that's part of what we're growing. And I just think it's really kind of a beautiful symbol of who we are as Americans and our wine culture here in this part of the country.
You know, getting back to my sort of larger point, which thank God you agreed with me, you know, that this book's a little bit larger than just, you know, growing grapes. You know, this whole idea of how a vine grows. And can you talk about this thing, the grapevine, and how vines grow as strongly in each different direction?
Yes. So a grapevine is just as much about the root system as it is about the vine that grows above the soil. And in fact, there's a lot of attention that goes into the root and developing the root. Grapevines are extremely hardy, strong individuals. If they are left to their own devices in the wild, they will do one of two things. They will either propagate themselves through grape seed and through animals, through birds and raccoons and whatnot, who eat the grapes and then take them the seeds elsewhere, and then a seed is planted, and then eventually you get a grapevine. They will also grow by growing as largely and widely and wildly as they can. And that is, growing upward into trees. They can also, if they don't have an armature to cling to and grow up, they will travel across the ground. And, parts of them that are connect with the soil in such a way can root again into the ground. They're really kind of amazing, mysterious creatures almost. And then you have this whole root system that dives deeper and deeper and deeper into the ground the older the vine gets. And, one of the concepts about wine and terroir is about minerality and about how the vine takes in the soil and how that is then translated through the grape and eventually into the fermentation of that grape into a bottle of wine. And the farther it goes down into the geological strata of the soil, the more mineral content it takes up as it searches out its food and water. So they're quite brilliant.
And you had described how some of them can go for miles.
Yes, there have been records of, some vines going for miles if they are left to their own devices and not pruned.
Now, we have a place up in the Champlain Islands, and the water tastes like sulfur. So what is a Vermont grape? What's a distinct mineral type flavor I might get from a wine?
I find things like slate. I think if we look to the kinds of things that we quarry here, for mineral, those are the kinds of flavors when you talk about wine tastes that I find in the wines here. There some wines can have a chalkiness to them, definitely slate, granite. In our vineyard here at the home farm, we also have a lot of quartz in the soil, which, more marble-like. You can think of things like, stones in a river, and what, if you were to actually pick up a stone out of the water and lick it, what that might taste like. So those are the kinds of mineral flavors that I think of when I think of Vermont's minerality.
Mm-hmm. You don't do that on a regular basis, right?
Licking rocks?
Yeah.
I try and do it as often as I can.
So you're up pretty high, so you were not affected, or were you, by Tropical Storm Irene?
We actually were affected. We are up pretty high, and of course we thought that we wouldn't have an effect because we're not in the valley. But we do have a stream that borders one side of our property that comes from the top of, as I was saying, Mount Hunger here in the Chateauguay. And that stream got blocked because of, tree refuse, branches and that kind of thing that was coming down at a very sort of rushing pace from the top of the hill. And when that became blocked, the water started to divert and go through, make other pathways, and totally took out our road because of the force of the water. And that happened in several places. There are several streams on Mount Humber, and so that happened in quite a few places, and the road needed quite a bit of work before it was back up and running.
But no negative effect on the vineyard or anything else?
No, we were lucky that the water coming from our stream from the top of the hill was actually coming right towards our house, and we were fortunate that our neighbor was already out on his tractor working to make new culverts to divert the water. So he was able to divert it from our house, and it didn't take a pathway through the vineyard or the gardens.
Mm-hmm.
So we were very lucky in that sense.
We're talking with Deirdre Heekin. She's the author of An Unlikely Vineyard, The Education of a Farmer and Her Quest for Terroir. Explain what terroir is to people.
I think of terroir as being six-sided. I think a lot of people immediately think of terroir as the geology of the soil. There's a lot of talk about that in wine. But there's more to it than that. I think that it's not only the geology, but it is also the geography. It's the varietal, the grape varietal. It's the climate and the microclimate in which the vineyard sits. It's the social culture around wine and food in your area, and it's the person also who's tending the vineyard and making the wine. So I think of it as this sort of six-sided honeycomb.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of honeycombs, you also keep bees, and you know, getting back to this sort of life lesson thing here, I was very interested in seeing your description of what the goal is of a beekeeper.
Oh, to simply, well, and it's the same goal, I think, for a wine grower or a vegetable grower, and that is to essentially be the guide or companion, just providing the space, not dictating to the farm, the plants or the animals on the farm, but working with them, you know, being a companion. And, you know, that's my idea of being a good farmer, is being a good companion. And it goes back to your idea about, you know, this whole idea we started talking about at the beginning of friendship or companionship.
And not extracting, you know, that the whole goal isn't to extract as much honey as possible.
Right, exactly. We need to leave something for the bees to survive, and we want to leave them something of their own creation. We don't want to take all of their honey and then give them sugar water to eat all winter, something they didn't produce that's coming from outside of them. We want to be able to, you know, the same with the plants and the animals that we have on the farm, we want to be able to leave them something of their own as well. And it's just, it's again this idea of companionship, I think, and being a good, in farming it was always called husbandry, you know, so being a good husband, being a good wife, being a good partner.
You know, you read and you look at your book, Deirdre, and you know, the photos. Who took the photos?
I took the photos.
Wow, they're exceptional.
Thank you.
I mean, it looks like this really idyllic, fun life. You know, you wake up every morning and it's a beautiful day, and the animals are all singing. So tell me, what's where the rubber hits the road here when reality hits in? What's the really difficult part about your life here, running this unlikely vineyard and the restaurant?
So the difficulty or the challenge is for us is about balance. You know, part of one of our philosophies about our work and life is in trying to create a balanced lifestyle in which we can, you know, enjoy our work, and that it is integrated into our daily life in a way that's kind of seamless. But with having both the vineyard, the farm, and the restaurant, there is a constant, our learning curve right now is about that juggling for balance of when things have to be done in the vineyard or on the farm, but also adhering to a restaurant schedule and, you know, prepping for dishes that we're going to be serving on a given night. So that's the real challenge, and it makes for very long days. And not much of a break. So it's a good thing that we actually really enjoy what we do, because it's work is kind of constant, but at least work is also play for us.
Mm-hmm. Have you learned anything from the farm? Have you learned anything from nature about trying to maintain that balance?
Yes, definitely. We can see how nature balances itself, and nature will always correct itself for balance. And I think what we learn from that is that if you don't take care to try and balance, things will happen that will correct that to create balance. And I think part of our job in how we try and manage these things is to try and find the ways to balance before nature has to correct us, because sometimes those corrections are not always positive things in the moment.
Hmm.
For example, you know, you're working so hard, you get sick. And, you know, because you're sick, you have to stop working for a little bit so that you can rest. So, you know, a goal would be to try and balance yourself enough in your work life and in your non-work life that you don't get sick or don't get sick as often, so that you have built-in rest, you have built-in ways to balance yourself.
Mm-hmm. Anything you would have done differently looking back 10, 15 years here?
Everything and nothing. I mean, I would not change anything, just because I think that the best way to learn is to learn by doing, and to also learn by mistake. When you make mistakes, the lesson that you learn from it resonates more than if I had studied all these things and learned them from a book and then happened, you know, kind of by luck to maybe do them correctly the first time around. I don't think I would have as deep an understanding of the process as I do now.
Mm-hmm. Give me an example of something, a mistake you learned from.
I think it's something like preparing beds for vegetables, preparing permanent beds. That was one of our early mistakes that in one of our gardens we're still learning the lesson from. When you don't prepare the soil correctly, in terms of how that bed is going to reside within an outer landscape that might have grass and weeds and those kinds of things. And our farm is in was a meadow that had not been worked for many, many years. So our initial effort was to create beds just by tilling and then planting into that. And that is definitely not enough work to do with the soil to create a permanent bed that is resides more as a bed rather than as something that the weeds are just going to overtake within mm-hmm. the season, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I'd say that was a lesson. You know, if we had been lucky and had done, you know, raised beds the first time around with lots of compost on top of a bare area, I don't think that we would have learned as much about the nature of the weeds and how to live with the weeds.
Okay. All right.
The understanding that we have now and that we're constantly learning.
Right. Well, aren't we all?
Yeah.
So where's your restaurant, and can people visit your farm?
Yes. So the restaurant is in the village of Woodstock, and Barnard is about 20 minutes from that. And we do accept visitors at the farm during the summer season by appointment on Monday, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays. And
okay.
They are welcome to email, and we're happy to have guests.
Thank you for your time this morning. That was really a lot of fun. What a neat book. Thank you for doing that.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on the show this morning, Mark.
Deirdre Heekin is the author of An Unlikely Vineyard, The Education of a Farmer and Her Quest for Terroir. Quick break, back after this.
Vermont Community Loan Fund borrower and Vermont business owner Bob Light talks about the Vermont Community Loan Fund.
When my wife Lee and I wanted to expand our Hollister Hill Farm bed and breakfast and to expand our farm store, we looked around for a loan. Traditional lenders weren't interested in our business plan. Then we heard about the Vermont Community Loan Fund. The loan fund looks at lending differently. It isn't just about the bottom line. It's about building Vermont's future, Vermont's businesses, and jobs.
The Vermont Community Loan Fund is a mission-driven lender. We focus on people, not profits. We're lending money to Vermont's small businesses to help them succeed.
The loan fund really looked at the whole picture with us. They saw how we were an asset to Vermont. Now, we're growing and proud to contribute to what makes Vermont work.
If you're looking for a business loan, look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund, where we look at lending differently. Visit investinvermont.org.
Do you have water damage or soot damage? Call SR Services in Montpelier. They're the experts. Don't get discouraged if your home has been damaged by water from flooding or a leaky roof. SR Services has the equipment and expertise to restore the appearance of your home to like new again. They work on tile and grout floors, too. Gray grout lines will be white again, thanks to SR Services. For water and smoke damage or professional carpet cleaning, call SR Services at 223-6577. SR Services, 407 Barry Street in Montpelier, 223-6577.
I'm Brandy Jacobin, a Vermonter and a mother. I believe an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure because I want my kids to live long, healthy lives. It's no wonder that one-third of Vermont kids are overweight or obese when sugar-added drinks are the largest source of their calories. Increasing the price of sugary drinks with a 2 penny per ounce tax would make unhealthy drinks more expensive for kids while funding programs in Vermont communities that help kids be more active. 2 pennies an ounce for prevention, 2 pennies an ounce for our kids. You can learn more at healthiervt.org.
Here's another Vermont Lottery Extreme Fun Alert. The Mega Millions jackpot is getting very large. You may want to go immediately to your nearest Vermont Lottery agent to purchase a Mega Millions ticket.
Hey, Vermont. This winter, it's a winter wonderland. And you could be laughing all the way to the nearest snowbank with Vermont Lottery Instant Tickets. Beat the winter blues with the $1 Winter Warmth Ticket. Win up to $50,000 instantly with winter winnings. And you might win some real money with flurries of cash and winter wonderland. Forget the cold and chill out with your favorite Vermont Lottery instant ticket today.
This is an Extreme Fun Alert reminder. The Mega Millions jackpot is getting very large. Buy your ticket today.
All profits benefit the Vermont Education Fund. Please play responsibly.
Today's estimated annuitized jackpot is $246 million.
Maplefields and Irving want you to ski for free. Fill up 3 times with Irving gasoline at their newest Maplefield store in downtown Newport, just off I-91 in St. Johnsbury, or any other Maplefield Irving locations, and you'll be eligible to receive a buy one, get one free lift pass at great local mountains like Burke, Jay Peak, Smugs, and Bolton Valley. With these new Maplefield locations, a great cup of coffee is never far away when you're on your way for an exciting day at the slopes. Come see them during their grand opening celebration in St. Johnsbury on January 22nd, 23rd, or 24th for awesome specials and prizes.
For the latest weather forecast, call the WDEV weather phone, 800-585-1211 or 244-1172. The WDEV weather phone, sponsored by Twin City Subaru on the Berlin Mall Road. Stop in today and let one of the gurus introduce you to Vermont's unofficial state car.
Hey, I want to thank the folks at Green Mountain Access, being a longtime sponsor here on the program as well. You can always send me emails to my account there at Mark, M-A-R-K, at gmavt.net. Want to sign up for their outstanding service? You can do so with a toll-free call at 1-888-321-0815. And you can get a lot more information on the web at gmavt.net. Thank you, John, for sending me a Snopes link here that turns out those localities that in the U.S., France, and Britain that are considered Muslim no-go zones, completely bogus. We'll leave you on that note today. This is FM 96.1 WDEV Warren, broadcasting from the top of Sugarbush in the flagship AM 550 WDEV Waterbury, Montpelier. It is time now for news.
AE Radio.